Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and with me, as always, is my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And Colleen's here on the couch with us, but not sure if we'll hear from her this episode or not. And their dog, Harvey, is sitting in between them, lovely. But we just finished up watching the 1958 Arthur Crabtree film, Fiend Without a Face.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I really did. It was one of those ones where, for the first half to three quarters of the film, I was like, yeah, this is kind of cool. There's some cool stuff going on. It's a little bit slow. I'm not 100% on board. And then the finale just blasted into outer space, and I fucking loved it. Like, not literally into outer space, but like it just kicked it up a notch, and good lord, I enjoyed the shit out of it.
Yeah, I think that's the attitude most people were going to take away.
Yeah.
From what I read on the internet, doing research and shit, everyone's just like, it's
fine.
It's average, like, and then the last 2 minutes is fucking amazing.
Yeah, you just gotta, it's a giant slow build up to a fucking phenomenal final set piece and finale.
It feels like, let's do a synopsis.
Yeah, synopsis.
There is the film is about a town that is dealing with these mysterious killings. And nobody knows what's going on. Meanwhile, there is scientists working on a missile control system.
Yeah, it's kind of Cold War era. It's a it's set in Manitoba, so it's kind of in the north of Canada. It's a U.S. Air Force base that are using radioactivity to heighten their radar system so that they can as an early detection system against the Russians.
Yeah, and so the villagers are thinking that, oh, it must be the atomic power that's causing these mysterious murders or whatever.
Little do they know that they are fucking mental vampire brain creatures that were created by an insane scientist's imagination.
Yeah.
Because he willed them
it
to
It was
be.
Like his brain fart.
Yeah. But we'll get to that later.
That's the big reveal. That's the reveal, which is an hour into the film, even more.
And no, I'd say an hour, and then you've got the last 15 minutes of just fucking bloodbath.
And and at that point, the film gets great.
Yeah.
So that's an hour into the film. The previous hour is filler and bad acting. It's charming.
I wouldn't necessarily say bad acting. I thought it was.
In particular,
leads, they weren't fantastic, but they did a very capable job, I thought. Like, I expected the acting to be a lot worse than it was. Similar to, like, last week with The Blob. Like, it wasn't bad. There were maybe a few bad people in it, but overall it was fairly, you know, serviceable.
It's another B-grade film.
Yeah.
And I think we mentioned last week that all B-grade films, you expect bad acting, and really you want bad acting. So do you really, with this kind of film, do you mark bad acting against the film, or does it get a free pass with acting?
I think it has to hit in that really sweet spot where if it's just bad acting, it can still just be really bad. It needs to be like really bad acting, like The Room level of acting to make it a fun experience. Whereas if it's just bad acting, it makes a bad film. But with this film, I think even more so than The Blob, I thought the cast were very charming, and they had actually a kind of appeal to them that even if a couple of line deliveries were a little bit shaky, you kind of forgave them a little bit. It wasn't... No one was bad. They were just, you know...
I laughed a few times at some...
Some of the villagers were a little bit
fucking
schlocky.
Ridiculous. But yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm not bothered. I'm not bothered in a B grade. In the context, fine.
Yeah. I think the first thing I had written down in my notes for this one was right from the get-go, I was absolutely shocked to see that this film opened with the MGM logo.
Like, yeah, it didn't... Well, they didn't produce it that way.
No, they distributed it. But yeah, I didn't expect...
This, like, I guess this maybe this kind of sci-fi shit was the flavor of the month, because it's certainly not a long... Like, sci-fi seems to ebb and flow. Like, you have... you have, like, right now, the sci-fi of today that's really popular, it happens to be, like, superhero stuff.
Yeah.
And then previously it was kind of, like, your horror, gory shit of the 80s, all the John Carpenter stuff.
Yeah, and even in the early 90s with stuff like Event Horizon and things as well.
And then through, kind of like in the 60s and 50s, you had this kind of thing, the Star Trek stuff. And
science fiction was used as an allegory to kind of point out, you know, the shit the countries, like the US was going through, in particular the Cold War. Yeah. So,
but it's always this ebb and flow. Like, you have like a good run of like 5 years, and then there's all of these people imitating, and then it kills the genre, and you have to wait for somebody to bring, like, breathe new life into it.
Exactly, yeah.
And I'm waiting for the superhero thing to kind of die, too.
Yeah. Well, the fact that Spielberg has even said, come out
it's
and said that it's going to implode, just like the West End did. Like, it's, yeah, which is pretty sweet. And I cannot fucking wait for that to happen. I'm so sick of superhero movies.
But it's not, because they'll keep coming out. But they still make heaps of cash. Yeah. So they're going to throw... I mean, like, some of them are going to be good. I mean, I got to admit that I'm keen for Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Yeah. Because that's, Guardians of the Galaxy 1 was something unique and original.
Yeah. That was a weird one, because it was like a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. In a stale genre.
In a stale genre. It's but kind of.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like a superhero film to me anyway.
Yeah. It was just within the Marvel Universe that it...
Yeah.
It was more of a Star Wars kind of rogue scoundrel going on an adventure kind of thing.
It felt like our generation's... Not like a kid's film for our generation, not new generation kids, because they're too wrapped in cotton wool. We grew up with much cooler shit.
Yeah.
But it felt like a kid's... Space adventure.
It was playing to the fans.
It's a space opera, just like Star Wars, and
but instead of being an opera, it was a punk mixtape.
Yeah,
yeah,
yes. But then the thing that it did right was you don't put kids in it.
Yeah,
that's like it frustrates me when you have superhero films or just general kind of the superhero film with young people in it.
Yeah,
because the producers or whoever's writing it assumes that
you need to hit that kid market.
Yeah, if you want to get something that, if you want to have a character that's cool for the kids, it's got to be a kid.
Yeah.
But then the kids, like when I was growing up, you want to be Han Solo or you want to be Indiana Jones. You don't want to be
Short Round.
Yeah.
No one wants to be
Short Round.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's what they did right with those films. Yeah.
Well, tying that back into Fiend Without a Face, like, yeah, it's kind of interesting. There are...
How are you going to tie that in?
Well, there is no kind of younger generation represented, and it is just a adult story. This is, like, trying to do... It is a very generic kind of science fiction tale, but at the same time, they're not trying to service individual kind of... meet all those kind of aspects of the genre, I guess. It's a very kind of adult... heavy, like there's no kids whatsoever in it. They're not trying to service that audience, and it's just like, nah, fuck it. This is a movie for genre fans, really, I guess.
Well, it's pretty gory, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And especially for its time, I would suspect that it's got like some high impact violence.
Yeah.
So yeah, I suppose it is made specifically for adults that happen to like pulpy B grade bullshit.
Yeah.
Was it B grade at the time?
It's very B grade.
Very B grade at the time. It was It was a second bill. It was one of those films where, you know, you'd pay your $1.50 or whatever and you would go see, you know, you get a double feature. And this was the second feature, which is always the schlocky bullshit. It's not the, you know, main movie you're going to see, so...
It's the booby prize.
Pretty much. And what a fucking prize it was.
But if you can sit through... Yeah, I really got an issue with... I really liked the film, but I really do have an issue... with just the filler in it, the scenes that don't really need to be in it, they're going nowhere.
I kind of disagree with that, because I think, like, initially you're given something that's very intriguing, where you get your interesting setup, and it's very good filmmaking, actually. You get the setup of the Air Force base, it's like that guard who gets killed, the first victim, and, you know, you get your sign saying where we are, what's happening, and you've got the plane flying overhead. And then you get the noise of the fiends, like the heartbeat and the rumbling sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get an off-screen kill, which I thought was kind of
funny. Yeah, I enjoyed that.
And the kind of Wilhelm scream, the guy dying, movie starts. And I thought it was really interesting. Like, that's a fun kind of cinematic way to get, kind of go like, okay, That's the mystery. I want to see where this goes. And then consistently, this film has a high body count, actually, for the 50s. There's, like, you know... 7-8 people get murdered before the finale. It's pretty good. but But in terms of the filmmaking, it's really good and consistent to keep up that mystery, because every time, like, the next people I think that die, you've got the old couple at the farmhouse.
Yeah.
And before they die, plane overhead, similar to the first incident, and then you get the ambient noise of the thumping and the heartbeat, and then the fiends come in. And, you know, later on we learn that the plane noise is incidental.
Yeah, that's just coincidence. But you do have, in addition, you have the plane going over a funeral as well, so it is playing on the villagers' minds as
yes.
well. I see where you come from.
Which is, it's really good filmmaking. True, it's effective, true. And what he's done with it is added that extra mystery of, like, we as an audience are going into this film knowing it's a creature film. It's called The Fiend Without a Face. We know it's going to have giant brain monsters.
Yeah.
But
I mean, look at the poster.
Yeah. But what they've managed to do is actually properly do a mystery where you're like, oh, I wonder if it is the radiation that is causing the, like, you know, is there something the government is doing this? Like, yeah, you don't kind of...
Yeah, is it the government's fault? Is it really something to do with the atomic plant?
It's kind of a nice misdirect without being...
Yeah. That's true. And certainly, bottom line is, if you have the planes going overhead during murders, then the motivations for all of the villagers is there.
Exactly. That makes that not so... Because otherwise, if we
didn't
have
that...
It
doesn't turn them into a stupid, angry mob.
Yeah, if we don't have that set up, it turns into the Salem Witch Trials. And it's just like, let's get the man in the coats! Like, don't... Like, we just are looking for a scapegoat and blame the government.
I dare say it's good writing.
Yeah. I'm also just going to put it out there that I find the planes going overhead in moments like that, when it's like a funeral or when it's just a couple in the yard feeding chickens, they're such peaceful moments, and the planes going overhead are really, really loud, and they make a point of them being really loud, really drawn out, and it's kind of, it's quite irritating and agitating, and it actually does, I think it did a really good job of making you unsettled.
Yeah.
It's building tension in the scene, right?
It builds a lot of tension in the scene. It interrupts what's going on. It makes you stop, and it just, you just kind of cringe that little bit, and it's really good. Yeah, in injecting tension into what's going on, but also like giving you the feeling that the townspeople are disrupted.
Yeah,
and like their peace is disturbed by the Air Force, and they're all on edge. So they're ready to believe anything, really. So I can believe the hysteria because they're on edge. The planes have been going overhead constantly for how long now? Like, the cows have just got used to it.
Yeah, so it's obviously been... And they had to actually... They've built a fucking nuclear facility there, so it's been a while.
Yeah, so you can understand the agitation of the townspeople and how you can feel that the peace there is broken, that something isn't right anymore. It's not what it used to be, and there's something that's invaded that peaceful space.
Yeah. But that being said, the kind of idea of the military being the bad guy, at least in the eyes of the townsfolk initially, I thought it was really interesting because, yeah, the planes are a total annoyance to them, but everyone that works in the military base and for the military are really lovely people and actually go out of their way to try and help and facilitate and apologise to all the townsfolk. And
they're the ones pushing for the autopsies. It's the townspeople who are saying no.
Yeah, they're like, no, let's actually try and find out what happened to this man. They're just like, I'll tell you what happened to him.
It was your fault.
It was your fault.
Can we prove it? No.
No. That's against God.
Please,
no.
Can we prove it? No.
No.
It's your fault.
It's pretty silly, angry mob.
Yeah.
That kind of shit.
Yeah. But it's interesting to see them contrasted with, like, it makes it interesting that the military people that they are, that is, like, you know, the focus of all their venom is really lovely people. Like, Major Cummings is totally charming, happy-go-lucky guy who is, like, is trying to get a good rapport and relationship going with the townsfolk.
Tim like, Robbins.
Clancy Everyman is what I had written down as in my notes. He looks like if Tim Robbins and Will Ferrell had a love child, I thought. But... yeah.
Yeah. There's not much character to them.
No.
yeah. I felt like I was just waiting for the creature.
Yeah. That's actually a good point. Like, did you care about anyone that died?
Not at all.
Yeah.
I didn't care about anybody that lived either.
this is true as well.
You know what I mean? I really...
Well, that's probably a good sign of a big movie then.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't give a shit. It's a creature film.
Yeah.
So, but that's why... I'm saying, like, the first hour was...
it was what
you
it
had
was.
To bear... I felt like it was just... I had to tolerate it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, saying that, can we talk about the ending, or would you like to... I'd like to just focus on the ending, personally.
Yeah. Just before we get into that, I thought, like, because I know when we get to the ending, I'm going to talk about things that I think have been influenced by this and kind of generally kind of take cues from this. But early on, I think there's some interesting stuff. Like, in particular, the old couple at the farm, the die in the barn. When that attack was happening, I couldn't help but think, I was like, this reminds me of either Critters or Tremors.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of both of these kind of like late 80s creature movies again. And I was like, oh, this kind of has that feel to it, I guess.
I'd like to, you can't really prove anything, but you can certainly entertain the idea that this was a seed.
Yeah.
In creature film
if it's history. If it's a well enough known film to be included in the Criterion Collection, you would assume that you can, yeah.
There were some fucking Evil Dead shots.
Oh, we will get into that, yeah. Well, I mean, fuck it. Let's just jump straight into the finale now.
Okay.
Yeah, so story-wise, where we're at is we've discovered... We've been given the story by the old professor in the town that he was experimenting with thought control.
Yeah.
He was trying to turn the page of a book and then using electromagnetic waves and shocking himself mentally...
Delicious 1950s science
fiction. Yeah, yeah. That makes absolutely no scientific sense.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, but basically he ends up working out a way that he can control things with his mind. And then he comes up with the genius idea that he is going to create creatures with his mind so he doesn't have to control objects with his mind.
I thought that, yeah.
But the creatures he creates with his own mind and radioactive power... go wild and
but
start
isn't it,
killing the task.
Yeah, is it that he is his thought has manifested into a invisible entity that can manipulate physical objects?
Yeah.
And
but he purposely was trying to create something to help aid him. But then it didn't work. Yeah. It was kind of a Frankenstein. They're trying to shoehorn a little bit of Frankenstein into there, I guess. Like the idea of, you know, his creating his
I like it.
Creature, but it turns and yeah.
I legitimately thought it was going to be just an alien film.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you have just a creature that invades. I think there's like there's a film. Help me out here. There's a film done by the guy that did the. It's like a brain slug film that was. Look at
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh my god. Just pause. I'll find it out. It's not Cronenberg. I don't know if it's Cronenberg. Man, I was researching silly creature films ages ago because I wanted to watch them. Brain slug film, I guess. Is it by the same guys that did maybe like Life Force?
Oh, Toby Hooper. The guy that made Life Force made Poltergeist. Or, you know, he's credited as making Poltergeist and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But, yeah, Life Force. You mean like the effects people that did Life Force?
Maybe.
Oh, Invaders from Mars?
No.
Invaders from Mars is a Toby Hooper movie.
I don't know, man. Fuck.
I'm thinking of Brain Damage. Brain Damage was something you used to watch as kids, I think. Something like that, anyway.
No. Oh, that's killing me. It's fucking killing me.
Move on. Omit that. We'll edit that out.
All right, fine. What are we talking about? We're talking about... we're talking about, like, brain infection.
Well, the idea of influence, I think, was kind of where we were kind of... had started from, and we were moving into the actual finale of the film itself. And,
I was talking about
where the creatures came from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The idea that it's great... I feel that it's great that it's not an alien.
Yeah.
But rather... like, just, like, those old-school sci-fi ideas where man creates monster.
Yeah.
And it's not a fantasy demon thing.
Yeah.
It happens to be the Frankenstein. It happens to be... it's like bringing back to life... or it's like all based off those experiments done where you electrocute the dead frog. And his leg...
Frankenstein.
It's like Frankenstein.
I think... I wonder if it was a purposeful note from the filmmakers to, and the writer in particular, to make it not be an alien, so it was totally okay for the military to just murder all of them.
Yeah, but the military would have murdered them if it was an alien. It's totally fine as well.
That's true, that's true. But I think, like, you know, we as an audience would be kind of like, whoa.
Well, this is, we've got to protect life here, guys.
Yeah, come on, like, whereas the fact that they're bizarre brain creatures that were manifested by this scientist who fucked up makes it be like, oh, okay, no, we can...
We all know that they're freaks of nature.
Yeah.
And they must be exterminated.
They're things that should not be, and they know that they should not be, and I don't know if it was the... But the design of the actual creatures themselves, I'm not sure if it was the stop-motion animation in which they were kind of shown to us, or the design themselves, but I got a very distinct Tim Burton feel from them. I think it was like the antler things and the tail reminded me of like the sculptures from Beetlejuice.
Oh, yeah.
So the same thing.
Yeah, so just like... And then when you first see
there's
that...
There's one
like,
sculpture that moves exactly
like that. Exactly like that, yeah. And then it looks... The design thing like of like the little offshoots and... They kind of have these little tendrils coming off to the side, and you're like, oh, that's weird. But then you start to see them use them as if they were arms to kind of lift themselves up off the ground. So it's actual practical purpose for those things being there. It's a really interesting design, and yeah, like I said, totally Tim Burton.
So am I to understand that the thoughts that have been farted out of this guy's head, they will exist by infecting the brain and brainstem of a victim... And then that brain stem and brain is animated.
Oh, no. Like, I have no idea. It's never explained.
Oh, okay. We don't have to worry about it.
What I kind of guessed was maybe that they're... Because they talk about how the spinal cord and the brain are gone or whatever from the victims. So I had a feeling they were just sucking it like vampires. They call them mental vampires. So I figured they were just using them for energy, maybe?
I thought they were possessing them. Why they look like that, because it's actually the actual brains and brainstems of the victims themselves.
But again, like in terms of awful script for this movie, you have that guy Gibbons, who was lost in the woods, and then comes back totally zombified. Oh, that's never explained and never mentioned ever again.
No, it's not. It's not. What happened? Maybe
what the fuck is going on
maybe
there?
Maybe that thought
just
kind of...
He was tormented in the woods and went crazy.
Is that it?
Okay. Yeah.
But
that's one way to explain it.
He's seen something that the others haven't and his brain snapped.
Okay.
Or maybe it was a kind of an infection that went awry and only part of the brain... Like, maybe his like cerebral cortex was sucked out and the rest was left, so now he's just like, you know, a zombie. A brainstem zombie.
How do they give him the lobotomy from the back?
I don't know, but how does any of this happen? So you could take it anyway.
Because to begin with, they're basically pure energy. That's how they manage to suck out a brain and a spinal cord through a hole in the back of the head. It's because they're energy. There doesn't have to be physics involved. They are energy, and that's how they do it. Once they take form, it's because that's the form that they take.
Yeah.
When they choose to become visible. Or when they become visible, they adopt
form. No, I think that their form pre-existed, because every time we see someone get murdered by the invisible thing, they're grabbing at their neck as if it was the cord wrapping around them.
I think they have like
they're
invisible
everyone's
powers.
Like,
so, yeah, I think they have invisible powers, and they always look like a brainstem. Because when one of them projectiles itself, it finally learns how to escape the lab by just chucking itself out.
Yeah.
It's not just... You know, a thought. It's an actual physical entity that happens to be invisible.
Yeah.
That just smashed through a window.
Yeah. It just launched itself out. Yeah. Goddamn. It's a weird movie.
It's
one of those ones
silly.
Where I think the further we debate, like, the actual practical purpose of these creatures, we're just going to go down a rabbit hole of contradictory ideas, because I don't think there is a concrete one that is presented in this film of what they are, what they're actually doing, how they're doing it. It's just a... Yeah, it's just things. Things are happening.
If you were tasked with remaking this film...
Yep. First of all, I would not do it, and I would pay Sam Raimi to remake this movie.
Yeah. But say... Okay, say you have to do the... You have to help with the script. Like, even just, like, the story concept itself. Would you include a reason why they look the way they do? A reason why they function the way they do?
No.
Or it's best to just leave it.
I don't think it's important.
Because everybody wants to see the creature.
Yeah, because I think, like we've been saying this whole time, like the first hour of this film is bullshit. Like it's nothing memorable. And like we've been saying, it is a giant lead up to that final 15-20 minute set piece. and that's all we give a shit about, getting there. And once we're there, we don't give a fuck about anything we've had in the past. We just want to concentrate solely on what is happening now.
Yeah. Harvey! Stop that. Take your drink out elsewhere, please. Everything else, all previous things don't matter.
Yeah, and...
You see this sequence, which we better explain, is simply... a shootout.
Basically,
Val's trapped inside.
We've got a couple.
House.
We've got the female lead, a couple of the military guys. Major Cummings, our protagonist. They're all held up inside the professor's house, and the brains have now put the nuclear power plant into overdrive and have drained so much power that they're now becoming so powerful that they are visible, and you can physically see them, and they're these brain creatures, and they are now just like, fuck it, let's... It turns into, like, Home Alone or Straw Dogs or whatever. Or Evil Dead.
The Evil Dead.
Yeah, there's creatures outside the house trying to get in. And they're these awesome brain things.
I mean, there's shots looking from the inside out where the windows are boarded up. They've boarded up the windows. And it's these kind of odd...
Kind of zoom shots?
Yeah, there's these zoom shots that are coming out to this, like... really oppressive, odd-looking forest with these creatures
which then flows into stop-motion practical effects, like very Evil Dead-like. Yeah,
it's super Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Like, there's no question in my mind that everybody...
Down to the point of, like, even in the finale, once Jeff, the military guy, blows up the power plant, the brains have no power and they melt, exactly the same way that in Evil Dead, when Ash burns the book, the Deadites melt. Like his possessed friends, they just decompose and melt. It's the exact same way. It's fucking great.
So this film, to me, even if it's treated as a poorly made film, which I think we're saying we like the way it's been shot.
Yeah.
Even though I would say that it's a bit static at the start. Whatever.
It's a bit static, but like we were saying earlier, the sound design elements and the building of tension and everything is purposefully done, and it's actually really well made. Like in terms of a narrative device and things like all the filmic elements are used perfectly to build tension and establish a mystery. It's just not a decent mystery that we really give a shit about. That's its flaw.
It worked better as an episode of The Twilight Zone.
It almost is. It's an hour 15 minutes long. It is not a long film.
Give it 45 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
You can keep the last half hour. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And then just get 15 minutes set up. Of just the town.
Just have the maybe two or three deaths as opposed to like seven. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's a fucking solid experience.
Oh, fucking A, yeah. No, I thoroughly enjoyed this movie, and the practical effects are just some of the best I've ever seen in a 1950s film.
There's a sequence at the beginning where it's like kind of a tease the creature sequence.
Yep.
Where they're still invisible and it's creeping up in through puddle, it's kicking over brooms, it's kicking over a bucket filled with water, and then it slides, still invisible, over the pool of water.
Yeah.
And it's this amazing, like, it's stop motion. They've kind of dabbed up got a towel and or some shit, just like cleaned up the water bit by bit.
As it's,
to make it look like this, like something, like some slug creature kind of sliding through, and then there's cutting through the fly wire.
Yeah,
This shit, I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's simple to do, but...
But it looks
fucking amazing.
Yeah, and it's something that you don't often see or expect to see in a 1950s film, and so when you see it, you're like, oh, wow, this is really fucking effective and really great and fun to watch, so... Fucking A.
It's one of those... It's almost a genius concept, because the creatures are invisible.
Yeah.
So you can do all this cool shit without any money.
But what's interesting about that is, like, we have invisible creatures, so they're doing all this cool practical effects early on, which led me to believe that, oh, once we finally see the creatures, it's going to be very schlocky and very hacky. But then when we see the creatures, it's like, oh, they step it up even further. Like, it's just a continually upping its game in terms of effects. It's fucking well done. Oh, the Crabtree, well done.
On a rewatch, it'd be better.
Yeah.
Because you would know you're counting down to that wonderful last 15-minute block of just brilliance.
Honestly, I think this is a Criterion DVD where you would have certain scenes that you would press next. Like, you would skip certain chapters on this DVD and just get to that fucking finale, I think.
Someone needs to kind of...
Do
take,
it.
Take the film.
A highlights
do
reel.
Do a re-edit.
I'm sure... I would not be surprised if this entire film's up on YouTube, honestly. I reckon that... There for sure would be a bunch of clips of this.
Like, trim all the fat.
Yeah.
I want to see
the fan edit.
I want to see a remake, actually.
See, I don't want to see a modern-day remake. I would have loved to have seen a 1980s remake.
There was a remake. I don't know if it was completed.
I'm going to look this up and have a
look. Have you got this on your trivia? I was hoping you had this on your trivia.
No.
I was looking it up because, you know, as I say, I want to see a remake. So I was like, I wonder if there is one in the works. Or was one, or can be one. Apparently there is one. But then it's talking about production occurred in 2011. Look it up. I think it's on the Wikipedia.
No, I haven't got anything on IMDb about it.
Yeah, you only go one source.
No.
Let me tell you. We'll start off trivia now, unless you want to...
Before we jump into that, is there anything else you kind of want to mention or go into, or do you think we've covered everything?
Do you think there's any... The fact that it's a person's thoughts come to life...
Yeah.
Do you think there is any satire to be had out of this film? Or social commentary to be had out of this film?
No, I don't think... I don't think this is one of those social commentary sci-fi films. I think this is just a monster movie that is built solely on the back of awesome effects and cool set pieces. That's what I think this film's purpose is, and I think it does it... Fucking A plus.
If there was the remake, I could see people injecting
exactly
social commentary through that pipeline.
Yeah,
and it'll have some meat.
There's meat to be had with it, but
should we explore it now?
I'd say it'd come if you're gonna get what.
You'd be fucked. What? Go on.
There does seem like there's a slight commentary there. But I didn't see it as part of
Fear of the unknown, I guess, or
no, the atomic power fear.
Yeah.
That hysteria about just it must be the radiation.
Well, that's what I was meaning, like
blaming
the fear of the
them
unknown.
For everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a very like uneducated, you know, small town people.
Yeah.
Just fearing atomic power, and they're like. Like really reasonable, like, but it's not true.
But that's
still like,
fucking happens.
Atomic power,
yeah.
You gave me cancer.
But when's Chernobyl? Like that would have been the late 40s. Is that late?
No, Chernobyl was the 80s.
Yeah.
Mm.
No.
But yeah, so I felt like there was that little bit of that in there, that little bit of commentary about, you know, the general public's fear of atomic power, and it felt like there was that little bit like the army or the air force in this case was like. No, it's cool. We're cool.
Yeah, so which set up the idea that there could be possibly shady deals, or they could be the source of what's happening. Yeah. But at the end of the day, nothing is paid off apart from the special effects. So that's what leads me to believe that, like...
And the fucking poster.
Yeah.
The poster looks awesome.
Yeah, they just didn't give a shit. They just wanted to make an effects movie, and they made a really good one, I thought.
Yeah, if they were smarter, they would have trimmed the fat.
Yeah. Well, screw it. Let's jump into the trivia now, and you can start us off this week with this talk of this remake you speak of.
Yeah. So, apparently, do you know who Roy Frumkus is?
Nope.
Yeah, okay. Well, he, in 2010, announced that he will make a remake in 2011. It's now 2015. The article concerning the remake kind of trails off. So I guess the guy was either high on coke and decided that it was a good idea on the night.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, he couldn't...
Or it just never really...
Or it just wasn't a good idea.
Yeah.
From the guy that brought you...
Yes?
Yeah, just hang on. There's nothing.
From the guy that brought you nothing.
he did nothing. The guy did nothing.
Oh, so this was just a coked out fever dream where he's like, I'm gonna make this movie again.
Like, well, Brain Monsters in 2015.
Yeah.
No.
Nah, fuck that guy. Let's move on to some trivia about the real Fiend Without a Face. So the 1958 British production was based on The Thought Monster by Amelia Reynolds Long, which was published in the classic American pulp magazine Weird Tales in 1930.
So it's already like a 30-year-old story.
Yeah, and then yeah, done masterfully here. In an interview, star Marshall Thompson, who was Major Cummings or Jeff, recalled that director Arthur Crabtree didn't really want to direct the film. He thought that sci-fi was beneath him.
Oh, god damn it. That
and,
sucks.
And often didn't show up for work.
I hate it, man. It's so annoying. Everyone, like, so many fucking people think they really love art.
British directors, yeah.
But just, no, it's just everybody. Everyone is just like, sci-fi is beneath me. It's not high-end art. It can't be art.
Eventually, according to Thompson, Crabtree walked off the picture and Thompson finished directing the film. Yeah, so basically the director walked off, stopped showing up to work, and eventually walked off the film, so much so that the guy who was the lead actor ended up finishing directing the movie himself.
No shit.
Yeah.
Well, who's responsible for the finale, though? That's the big question.
I would not be surprised if it was Marshall Thompson. This, the guy, because he's not in the scene.
True.
The majority of that, he's not actually in it. He kind of disappears for the finale, so I wouldn't be surprised if...
That's the genius of it, because the rest of it is really, you know, paint by numbers. We need to have this static shot of establishing. We need to have a static shot of these two fellas talking to each other.
Yeah.
And then you get all these like weird, wonderful things occurring with the camera,
which might have been because it was some guy who was not actually ever trained in filmmaking. So he was just like, "Yeah, let's just put it there."
I think this is going to work.
Well, let's just put it here. That'll work, and it really did. The film created a public uproar after its premiere at the Ritz Theatre in Leicester Square. The British Film Board of Film Censors had already demanded a number of cuts before granting it an X certification.
Is that because of the gore?
It was because of the gore.
But it's creature. It's not like people are being.
But 1958.
Yeah.
Like, think about like the classic one. I always
just
jump back
to. Change the color of the blood to green.
Well, it's like almost a black in this. But what?
Huh? Is it because it's black and white?
Well, no, it's like it's a dark color.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like red.
Yeah.
Red's more of a greyish tone.
But, like, the comment on, like, censorship and things and censor boards with film, the key one I always jump to is in 1960, so Psycho. Psycho was the first film to ever feature a flushing toilet.
Yeah.
And a cop shit for that.
Yeah.
Like, that's how hardcore it used to be in the 50s and early 60s, like, so...
It's
the fact that you have, like, a guy impaling a fucking brain creature with an axe.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of fucking exploding and, like, bubbling dead brains in this. Like, it's a pretty hardcore movie at the end.
Man, if you were to make this color and put it in the 80s,
yeah,
it would fit right in.
Oh, 100%. It almost has, like, that kind of B-grade, kind of early Peter Jackson feel to some of the effects and the deaths, so...
You know what I would like to see is just somebody just stomping on one.
Yeah.
And just having a wet meat sack.
That's exactly what I said that when we were watching it. Like, the thing that I thought was missing was at no point did someone kick one or stomp one. Yeah. That would have just been...
That's an effect that we needed to see.
Yeah. A little bit of comedy added in. I think that horror comedy would be great.
Maybe Famke's remake.
Yeah. And the final bit of trivia I have is that a publicity stunt went somewhat wrong in New York City. The Rialto Theatre in Times Square featured a sidewalk promotion for the film. One of the props of the brain creatures was on display in a cage, wired with sound and motion. The crowd it attracted grew so large that the New York City Police Department had to have the whole exhibition removed because it was like the crowd was so massive it was bleeding off into the streets and disrupting traffic.
People needed to see it.
Yeah, fucking A. But that's all the trivia I have for this film. So we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still in print, and it's available as a one-disc DVD through Criterion. It's also available on iTunes or Hulu Plus. But the physical DVD comes with the special features of an audio commentary, which is a conversation with executive producer Richard Gordon and genre film writer Tom Weaver. Illustrated essay on British sci-fi horror filmmaking by film historian Bruce Edder. A collection of trailers from Gordon Films, which include Fiend Without a Face, The Haunted Strangler, Corridors of Blood, First Man into Space, and The Atomic Submarine.
Rad.
As well as rare still photographs and ephemera with commentary, vintage advertisement and lobby cards, as well as the usual kind of booklet and essays the Criterion usually do. It's interesting to note that some of the ones, the other Gordon films, I think like First Man into Space and Atomic Submarine, there is actually a box set of, I think it's called like Monsters and Martians later in the collection, and both of those films are in that box set. So
that sounds super juicy.
We'll get to explore some more films from the guys that made this.
Well, I think we're in pretty good hands. I mean, like, depends if it's the guy that walked out or it's the guy that...
no, it's more the producers.
Right.
Yeah, but that'll about wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at Arthur Crabtree, or I guess Marshall Thompson's Fiend Without a Face.
Yeah.
If you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter at @CriterionQuest. Other than that, we will be back next week when we have another Powell and Pressburger film, when we look at Black Narcissus. Narcissus, or however it's pronounced.
Who's another what?
Powell and Pressburger.
What else?
The Red Shoes. The same filmmaking team that made The Red Shoes and Peeping Tom.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah.
I assumed it was going to be another Black Orpheus.
No, it's what this one is. It's
we don't
about,
want that.
No.
We want another Red Shoes.
Yeah, it's about a group of nuns who move to the Himalayas to start a monastery.
Oh, good.
And it is
so nothing like
it is
Black Orpheus.
No, it's considered to be one of the most visually beautiful films ever made.
Excellent.
So yeah, should be good.
Another one for the Twitter feed.
Exactly. I'm sure we'll have a lot of Twitter images for this one. But yeah, for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
I'm Cole.
See you next time.